First of all, I'd just like to ask you how both of you became involved with Greenham. Don't worry, you don't have to keep your commentaries separate. We will just go for it. All right. So, yes, how did you become involved? How did you become aware of the movement?
Can I go first?
Yes, go first.
Oh, okay. Well, I used to live in Andover, Hampshire, which is about 15 miles from Newbury. And my parents were, well, we were a Catholic family, and my parents were part of a Pax Christi peace group. So when Greenham became known about on the media, the church would take food up. My mother used to make soups, and we'd go up there after church, after Mass on a Sunday, and feed some of the people at the camp. So that went on for a while. So that probably was about 14, 15, it was 81. And then a couple of years down the line, I was doing my A-levels, and I decided to make a project on the Women Agreement, because I was quite fascinated in what they were doing and the strength that they seemed to have. So I then started to do my... Well, I kind of knew quite a bit about it, because I'd been going backwards and forwards with my parents. But independently, then I started doing my own research and used to cycle to Greenham and talk to people. I was writing to MPs and compiling a little booklet that I did, made. And then a couple of years later, a year later, I left home and I went to work in Guildford with the homeless, and it was kind of residential living, voluntary, social work thing, you know, like you used to do before you went off to do your... sorry, I'm not looking at you, am I?
No, it doesn't matter. Please, you don't have to. Just look wherever you want.
Yeah, before, I was planning to become a social worker, so I thought I'd been working with the homeless, but I never actually became a social worker. But in my time off, I would get the train to Greenham and go visit, and I stayed. I stayed once.
For how long?
Only the night. It was February, and it was so cold. I remember waking up in this bender with snow, 4 inches of snow on my feet. It was the coldest I've ever been. I had to get back to work anyway, the day or two after. I was also involved in Cruise Watch, which was sort of part of to do with Green. Well, it was to do with Greenham, yeah.
Where was that?
That was when I was living in Andover. So we'd get phone calls in the middle of the night, and everybody would kind of hook up with whoever had a car, and we'd make our way there to the Berkshire countryside and watch the convoys go through the villages, through the back roads. And it was probably the scariest thing I've ever seen. It's quite terrifying.
Enormous,
really.
Big trucks, weren't
they?
Yeah,
it just went on and on, weaving through. And it was in the middle of the night. It was so silent and so secretive. Mm. It's terrifying. It was like you know, being in a horror movie, really.
What was the purpose of the watch? Was it just to know where it was going, or were you trying to prevent
it? I think it was... Well, we'd never prevent it, because it was, you know, it was army and police, but I think it was to say that if a bunch of, you know, activists could to find out where it was so easily...
Anyone could, yeah.
You know, anybody could, so... Yeah, that was it. Yeah.
That was the whole point about the demonstration, really, wasn't it? Mm. To show how easily you could get into the base. That's why they kept breaking in. And then they reinforced it threefold, I think. Yeah. They put three different fences up.
Really?
And they still got in. Mm.
Gosh, I've never appreciated that from the pictures. It's always going over one
so
fence.
Reinforced.
Yes.
And I suppose the other thing about Cruise Watch was that they used to take the... lorries with the cruise missiles out at night. I don't know to this day whether they were really on there. But they then took them to the Cotswolds and places like that in the middle of the night and try and find a copse that they can maybe launch a missile from. So the whole thing was trying to draw awareness to all those people that lived in that area that this was going on.
Mm-hmm.
You
know,
in the veil
hours.
Of darkness, yeah. These... weapons of mass destruction were on the road.
Polly, how did you become involved?
My parents, all my family have been in C&D, and I, from a very early age, I used to go on demonstrations with them. And we were in Hanover Square, the anti-Vietnam demonstration, when the horses charged, the police charged on horses. So I've just grown up with, you know, those sort of sentiments that, you know, no war and pacifists. Sentiments. And then when Greenham happened, I was living in Worcestershire, so it wasn't a million miles away. And one of my bosses, he was also very into C&D, and his wife went to stay at Greenham. And Dave and I used to, I was a member of the Labour Party as well, we used to do lots of, because it was a design practice, I'm a graphic designer. After hours, when we'd done NFU Mutual and Avon Insurance and all those other things that were the bread and butter work, we used to get some beers in and do C&D posters, Labour Party posters, the local Gloucester C&D peace group, and things like that. And it was through Dave that I was aware of Greenham. And as I said earlier, I was kind of always hankering to get there, but at that time I didn't have a vehicle and I didn't actually drive. So then I passed my driving test, and one of my very first trips was to Greenham. And then from there I used to go quite regularly and take vegetables, because I lived on a, I didn't live on a farm. Well, I did sort of live on a farm, but there was always produce that I could, you know, grab a crate of apples or bananas and go and visit, and go for those special days. You know, when 30,000, is it 30,000? Mm. I say it's 30 million, but it wasn't 30 million. But anyway, where we all held hands around the base. And
you both were there, weren't
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think there were more than one of them actually. Sort of did them.
She's on the other side.
I took some photos on one occasion. We were at Main Gate, and I got up on the wire, so I sort of was able to direct my camera down on the women, sort of charging the gate, and they were knocking all the policemen's helmets off, and I've got a photo of all these helmets lined up.
Have you still got that photo?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
And in that, in one of the photos, I said, well, that could be me. That could be me. You kind of forget what you look like. I've got them there. I'll show them to you.
Oh,
yeah, and I've got a photo of a woman going through the wire and, you know, soldiers marching up and down. And they're not very good quality prints, but the negus are there.
Yeah,
you get some good.
Mine went and skipped by accident. It's a shame.
So, in terms of roles that you played, you've mentioned that, Claire, that you were out on cruise watch, Polly, that you were there and took some photographs. Mm.
And I was on cruise produce. Watch too. I was part of that.
Right, right.
Shane.
So, what other sort of events were you part of? You've just mentioned the circulating 30,000 ladies, women.
Yeah, I can't remember now. I've got those newspaper cuttings, so they would have been the things that I attended. We can go through that later and have a look. I remember, the main one I remember is the, you know, the holding the hands around the base, and there were lots of lie-ins on the street, on the road, when they were trying to get the diggers to destroy the camps.
And crews, the part of the crews watch was that you alerted everyone. It was a telephone chain, and then people drove there. And although they obviously weren't there to see the vans go out, they would lie on the pavement on the road in front of Main Gate to try and prevent them coming back in. And I think someone got run over, I'm sure. Have you heard that? I'm sure a woman got run over because she wouldn't move, and they drove over her. It's desperate, isn't it?
Absolutely.
There are lots of things I heard but didn't witness, like the vendors being sprayed with freezing water from the council to get the women to move. You know, and this is in the middle of winter. Didn't witness it myself, but
Did you associate with any of the particular gates, the different coloured gates?
I think so, but again, I can't remember. Because I never stayed for a huge chunk of time. My visits were always short visits. and I was young and I was so shy back then, you know, I couldn't really, you know, I wasn't probably relaxed enough to sort of hang out there for any length of time and sort of integrate with the people.
You did well in respect, you went and interviewed them, so
yeah,
I think that's amazing.
To talk to them, yeah.
For someone so shy. Yeah.
So, Polly, you were taking produce. Did you always take it to the same place, or was it all? How was it organised?
No, I would just go and dump it at the nearest gate, whichever way I went there. No, I didn't run away. No. Yes, so I kind of spaced it out.
Yes. I mean, were the women delighted to see you with the produce, or did they see you as somebody who... Did they see you as part of them?
I think so. I used to get, you know, have a cup of tea and things like that, and then go for a walk around. And but I think I wasn't the only person. Lots of people would take food and sustenance to them. So maybe, you know, a crate of apples wouldn't go very far anyway, would it?
I think there was a kind of us and them, like one week somebody might be visiting with food, and the next week they might be living there. And it was just interchangeable.
It was all inclusive as well. Yeah. You know, no one was excluded. The sheer fact that you'd actually got there. And even, I think point to make also, it was women, only women stayed there, but men used to go regularly to support the women. Although they weren't ever allowed to stay there because it was meant to be a peaceful, women-only protest. But on all those... you know, days that I went there, there would always be, you know, children and men around supporting their women folk.
Did the men have a role?
No, they probably just brought the kids. If their women were staying there, they'd bring their kids at the weekend, so they saw them, and food and anything, I suppose, that any demands that...
So they were very much back up?
Well, they were, but it was also the men, going back to the cruise watch, it was also the men that were greatly involved in cruise watch, because obviously the women were there. Then they would alert whoever was at home, or, you know, to get that chain going. And generally it was like Dave, his wife Gaynor was staying there, and she would ring him up and said they'd gone out. And then he would start, you know, ringing everyone else and getting in the car and going there. Yeah.
That's really interesting. That's an aspect I haven't appreciated.
No, I think you mentioned, I read Claire's project, and I think it's kind of highlighted in there that people seem to, they sort of, I think it was easy for the media to just think, oh, it was a bunch of, you know, weird women, lesbian women that all just went there to kind of lived together, but it wasn't like that at all. I mean, the initial people that walked from South Wales, I mean, they were married with children, and they, you know, that. I mean, admittedly, there were some lesbians that obviously got caught up in it, but that wasn't what it was about. But it was just easy for the media to blacken them. And then with the local residents of Newbury, they kind of got them to taint them as well, didn't they? And they were frightful to them. When they first started going there and maybe going to have tea in a tea shop or going to get groceries, it was okay. But then after a while, and they'd been there for so long, the shop holders wouldn't serve them.
But, I mean, of course you're going to look grubby if you haven't had a bath for weeks.
Well, of course, yes.
Living in mud in the middle of winter. But it's the same old thing, isn't it? The travellers get accused of things.
It's anything that's out of the ordinary, know, that's... I mean, in 1980, that wasn't where women should be, is it? Sleeping under plastic sheets called benders.
Cutting wire, yeah.
And it's interesting, Claire's project, she put out a... What do you call it, questionnaire? Questionnaire to fellow 17, 18-year-old students. And I found those kind of really, really fascinating to get some feedback from her contemporaries.
My target audience were studying politics, history and politics.
They were meant to be, but they were so unaware of... Yeah.
Was this when you were at school still?
No, A-levels.
A-levels. So that you're talking about 17, 18-year-olds had no idea what was going on.
Well, they must have done, because when we lived, we were all in Andover, so it was a college in Andover, so we were only 15 miles away. So they were all my age, but I targeted my questionnaires at students that were studying politics and history, so I thought, because I thought they'd be the kind of the most savvy and the most interested. I didn't go for people that were studying catering or... might have been more useful. So it's interesting because I got the responses there, and we were looking at them the other day, weren't we?
I said to Claire, "Can you remember something that so and so?" And I said, "She's just like so pig ignorant. I don't understand how she can write such tripe." It was interesting because not one of them, actually, only one. One of them showed full support towards the questions and the direction that your questions were leading. But she hadn't been there.
Mm.
A lot of them said, "Oh, we drive slowly past, but keep going."
What size was this sample?
Got them there.
Yeah,
should I find them?
The red one, I think. It's
in the back of that one, isn't it?
Probably 30, I don't know, I can't remember.
Yeah. So, it was yourself, Claire, that actually spent one night there. Can you still recall what the facilities were for things like sanitation, for toilets?
I don't remember that. I remember the arriving and there being a fire. And I think it was, I said, February, it was very cold. And being invited to join them around the fire, and there was a kettle and they're getting a cup of tea in a really, really grubby mug. It was so filthy and cracked. It was wonderful. And then being asked if I was staying overnight, and I said I would, I'd like to. And somebody said there's a bender over there, so tuck yourself in and find a corner. And I did, and I had a night where probably everything is so cold, and you sort of doze off for an hour, and then you wake up. And
did you have a purpose for being there? Because I understand there were some who went in and supported the women so they could sleep, and you did the night.
No, work. I just turned up. I was working in Guildford, the homeless, and I had some time off, and I thought I must go and stay at Greenham, and rather than just visit, I need to go and stay there for a couple of days. So I just turned up really for the experience to see what it was like.
What did you find, because of Greenham, this Greenham was an influence on yourselves, on your thinking, on... In what way?
No, it was a big, strong, powerful thing. Mm. When obviously my persuasion was always, to go on these marches. I used to go to all the anti-Reagan marches. I remember one from Hyde Park to the American Embassy, and every quarter of an hour or on the hour, we all had to lie down wherever we were and pretend that we were dead. And I remember being on the hour in Marble Arch in the middle of the road. And lying down in the middle of the road in Marble Arch with all these other people, it was quite an amazing thing. So a lot of it was that sort of buzz to be surrounded by people that all were the same way of thinking as you.
They're just self-assured. They kind of had confidence in what they were
exactly,
doing.
Exactly, because then we would all...
Rather than sort of being the weirdo.
Yeah,
safety quite. Numbers.
Yeah. When you're at school and you've got views that don't go with the mainstream, it really makes you feel like you're a bit odd. But suddenly,
you found other people
out
there.
It's okay to be odd and challenge and question, and you feel stronger for it. Yeah, it's like finding although there was mud and wet and cold, you it's like finding your tribe almost. Yeah, it was good. It's just a shame that people had to find each other. Because of such a desperate situation, I think. Yeah.
But I suppose it will always be, won't it? Mm. People rising up and with their principles. It's always against something, isn't it? Something that you see is wrong. I mean, at the moment, it might be I won't talk about Brexit because I can't stand it. I can't even stand the name, you know. And deals. Why can't they have an arrangement? Why has it got to be a deal? But I was thinking more of, you know, university fees and things like that. We're quite long in the tooth now, quite old and quite exhausted. I mean, all of my youth that was about that, and I kind of find it quite refreshing when some young things stand up now and take up the helm, so to speak, because I really am quite burnt out with it all. You know, you get to a point where I just can't do any more. So the young ones have got to come, you know, come through and...
Did you have any prejudices or preconceived ideas before you went to Greenham and met the people of Greenham?
Only the... no, not personally, but as I was saying earlier, there was a lot of prejudice and it was media-generated. Mm. So I don't know what you thought when you first went there. What were you expecting?
I was going there with food from quite a young age and I was fascinated by it. But I think for me, the biggest thing that... the thing that worried me or questioned me, that I questioned, was the people that worked there, the police, the people that were having to put up a barrier. Because my brother, he's 2 years younger than me, and he used to come along to take the food as well. He then went off to join the police force and became a policeman. And I used to worry about people that were in this role, paid role, that had to, you know, do something they didn't necessarily agree with. And I just find that intriguing. You know, the people on the other side of the wire. And I wonder what their thinking is now. Have they stayed with... I don't know, it'd be difficult, mustn't it? Because you've got to keep your opinions to yourself.
It's an interesting thing, because on those marches through London, the various one I went to, the police would line the roads, but they were peaceful. They were C&D marches, or, you know, anti-war, or nuclear disarmament. And yet, the police would kind of... They could touch hands. And I remember walking along after the Marble Arch, for instance, on this particular one, walking along Oxford Street, and just the police were just lining Oxford Street. And, it wasn't going to be a riot. I mean, admittedly, they always used to have the anarchists that would do a bit of a disturbance somewhere, maybe for a brick in a shop window. I don't know what they did. But mainly it was a peaceful thing, and yet they seemed to... have all these police, and they would be po-faced, and, you know, people would say things to them, like, you know, do you want to take your hat off and join us? And, you know, they'd just completely ignore us. But, you know, 50% of them can't have wanted to be there.
Mm. I saw a lot of confusion on the faces of the police, especially when there was sort of threats and war.
Well, I know, they didn't... They really didn't know what to make of that sort of direct action, did they, with the women?
They were doing things that they considered were quite bizarre, but they didn't understand where they were coming from and where they were going. And they were trying to... Yeah, very kind of straight-thinking people trying to deal with this... You know, it must have come across as quite chaotic.
Did you... yes, you came... in contact or sort of aware of the police when you were doing the C&D marches. Did you have any contact with them at Greenham in any of the protests?
Yeah.
They were there. The one I took the photos of them, there with the women.
Personal.
But it was more soldiers, and it was more American. I mean, one of my most shocking things was at Greenham, there was a woman, and she was an American servicewoman, with a gun on her hip. And, of course, we didn't see guns in those days on the streets. And I think that a lot of the women were saying to her, you know, you're on the wrong side of the fence and, you know, leave your gun and come over here. And you know how they would have and she wouldn't, converse with us, or she wouldn't engage with us in any way at all. I did take a photo of her and her gun. But that for me was quite shocking. Because police never had guns. They weren't armed, were they, in the 80s?
So you didn't ever, you were never near when the police actually, there was any confrontation between the women and the police? And
yeah, I think
that's my vision.
Yeah, no, it was, but I think they probably, because I was younger, they probably would look for who they would consider the ringleader, sort of like the older, more competent ones. So I never got involved on any sort of. Yeah, no, I never got arrested.
Are you...
There was a moment. I remember the fence being pulled backwards and forwards and people were going in. And there was a moment. I was meant to be back at work the next day in Guildford with the homeless. And I remember debating whether to go in or not, because I knew I'd get arrested if I did. And I didn't. I don't think I did go in the end, because I knew I had to be on duty. So that was a difficult moment, trying to make that decision, because I really wanted to, but I knew I'd be carted off. Plus, I had my dog with me. So that was a difficult moment, yeah.
You just said that your brother went into the police.
Yeah.
Was he a part of your church when you took supplies up to them?
Yeah, that's one thing, yeah.
And so, in a way, it seems a slight contradiction.
Mm.
What took him into the police? Did he see himself being able to do something different?
I think so. I think he originally joined the police with the intention of trying to make things better.
Yes.
I think that was his original intention. And I think, I don't know, I don't see very much of him now. I guess you stay in and you get a pension, you get long in the tooth and you get cynical. And I think that's where he is now.
About to say something.
I was going to ask you, on your list of women that you're interviewing, are you perchance going to interview any of the women that spent some time inside you are? Because I think they were...
Within the camps or within prison?
In prison.
At the time, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I'd be really interested to know what they were arrested for. Mm. Is it crime, riotous behaviour or... I don't know, it always fascinated me why there were women being banged up, so to speak.
Mm. No, we certainly encourage those interviews, because they're fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Now, it was interesting what you were saying about the men, that whilst they weren't in the camps, that they would come supported weekends, and also that they were a part of the crew's watch.
Yes, they were.
Any other roles, or were you aware of the fact that they were excluded from the women's camps? Were you?
I was aware that they were excluded from the women's camps.
Do you think they should have been?
Oh, that was one of your questions, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it was a process, I think, that they arrived at. It didn't happen immediately when the women marched from Cardiff. I think the men were at the camp to start with, and then
they marched with them as families.
Sort of worked out this process would be strong if it was women only. And I think, as I said in the book somewhere, that for centuries men have gone off to war. Now women are leaving home for peace, and it was that kind of idea that women were making a deliberate, conscious effort on their own to do something in the name of peace. That it would be stronger, I think.
You mentioned that you wrote letters to the MP, and you yourself, you're making...
Designing posters
for the Labour Party.
And I was the press officer for my local peace group. There were other things that... I mean, Greenham wasn't... That was just part of... what I did, as I say, I was a member of CMD, and also Greenpeace. We used to invite speakers to come and talk to us, and so I was very active.
Yes. What was the reaction of MPs? Did they want to know about it, or was there a denial that it was happening?
I was just sort of pompous.
Is that political?
Yeah, you can have a look through these afterwards.
Did you feel you were having any impact by communicating with them?
No, I think for me, I wasn't expecting anything, but I just wanted to try and get a balanced but two-sided thing for my project. I was never going to shift the outlook. Yeah.
Mm. Did you have anything to do with the local council in Newbury?
The local
council. Yes, you've got your local councillor, haven't you?
Yeah, I think it's one of you. He actually went off ill, didn't he, Michael McLean?
Oh, yes, he was very conveniently ill.
He just went off sick, and then I got David.
Probably made him sick.
Yeah. David Mitchell.
Is it David Mitchell?
Who's this one? Stephen Locke. Oh, he's on behalf of. Yeah. Well, anyway, you probably don't want to look at them now, but they're all there to. I haven't refreshed. I haven't had a moment to refresh my.
Don't worry.
My memory.
You haven't quite looked there.
Yeah.
So, Polly, were you working at the same time? Because Claire was doing sort of social work.
So I was a bit younger than you. Well, I'm a bit younger than you.
My 4 years old.
Yeah.
I was working in Pershore in Worcestershire in a design, graphic design place. So I would work during the day and then go to Greenham at the weekends. Not every weekend, I couldn't really afford to, you know, do it every weekend, but when I could, I would. And sometimes, because my mother was still living in South Croydon, and on the weekends that I went up to visit her, sometimes I would go that way. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit out of the way, but yeah. Mm.
So from what you were saying, your family were very sympathetic to this kind of movement. What about you?
They were, because they were in this peace group, you know. And I think that they were very much influenced by the kind of Gandhi non-violent direct action sort of approach, which is what the women were doing. Even my father was, very mixed military man, because my father was in the RAF. He was quite sympathetic as well.
Maybe being in the RAF is what...
Right. Yeah. And so, actually, he was very much for the peace, for side. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, his role in the RAF was communications.
Were there individuals that influenced you at that time, or which individuals would have influenced
you? From Greenham?
Yes, or Greenham, or any of the movements at that time.
Well, I suppose Gandhi, as you're saying, was quite an important role. Yeah, I remember my mother, she was always on about Mother Teresa, but I'm not so sure about her. You know, there were little sort of pictures of her all over the house. But yeah, those are the kind of things that we had going on in the home.
Yes. Were there individuals for you, Polly?
E.P. Thompson was with the Protest and Survive and his writings.
Right.
Who else was... Julie Christie was a member of CND. And Bruce Kent.
Yeah.
And then Joan Ruddock.
Yeah.
Alistair Campbell was another one. I remember he had his house broken into and he had lots of papers removed. Lots of things like that were going
Tony
on.
Tony Benn.
Okay, Tony Benn, of course. Yep. I'm trying to think who. No one in particular, but just the whole.
Just interested, because earlier you mentioned the fact that you felt that maybe your phones were being tapped. At what stage was this? Was this
early.
Later on?
No, or? Early. Yeah, beginning.
At the beginning of the Greenland time?
Yeah, I'd say early 80s. When because later on I was going up on my own and cycling or getting the train, but when I was going in the early days when I was younger, when it began, I was going up with my family and my father would drive up after church and we had the registration plate and I remember seeing people coming round taking them down, and then soon after that we noticed that the phone was making some strange clicking noises every time we picked it up or had you know, made a phone call. So that was in the early 80s, yeah.
And other people you associated with at church or the movement, were they having the same?
I don't know, there were that many people from church going. We were quite isolated, really, so very insular families. It's not like we talked to other people. But I've had this conversation with Polly, and you had suspect, you know, later on, you suspect a similar thing was happening.
Well, as I say, I saw it at that Coventry demo. They were definitely writing, must have been number plates, I can't remember what else it could have been. And so that, hence that question about, you know, being termed a list of subversives.
Yeah, with me, with my family, is that my father did apply to work at GCHQ in the 60s. So I wonder, you know, if there was any sort of... I mean, you start to wonder if you're being paranoid, don't you? If there was any surveillance going on with him, with the GCHQ links, and then Green and his RAF background, and working for the Home Office as he was then, and the clicks on the phone, and yeah, I don't know, I'm sure there was. Yeah. I don't know.
Interesting, yes. I think I sort of said earlier, but how do you feel Greenham impacted on you in terms of path you followed?
I think we've followed the path anyway, the way I've gone. But it was good to meet other people that had a similar outlook. Yeah.
And to support the women.
Yeah.
You know, every time anyone went there, it was getting their numbers up, showing them support, and because there must have been times over the years where they felt so isolated and, you know, alone there. Sometimes it was quite sparse because seven or nine gates, I can't remember. Is it nine gates? I can't remember how many. They all were colours, weren't they?
It was 9 miles, wasn't it?
Oh, sorry, 9 miles, seven gates, possibly.
Because it was the colours of the rainbow, wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah. And sometimes maybe there would only be a few at one gate. I think there were gates that people preferred. Could you ask that question? Was there any particular gate that I'd go to? But I think the women that were living there, presumably, they had their preferences where they were going to stay.
But at the end, I mean, there was a caravan, and there was a, you know, a shoestring of women that were hanging on to the very end, to the missiles went.
And that's right.
They would have got next to no support, really.
No, that's right.
But they just kept going. I mean. That's a woman who was there for about 20 years, I think.
An acquaintance, I can't say friend, someone called Caroline Blackwell wrote a book.
Look, she went and stayed there.
Oh, wonderful.
I don't know whether you've seen that book.
No. She was on the perimeter.
On the perimeter, yeah, she stayed at
Blackwood.
It's got Women at the Wire, you know that one.
That's right, yes. But this is really interesting.
That's her diary of her time there. She's a big drinker, and she just arrived with a crate of whiskey, I think.
It's everybody.
It's quite
interesting.
So I read that. I can't remember when that was published, and that kind of reinforced things for me.
How interesting. I'll have a look at that in a moment. That's lovely. Thinking on, over the past 25 years, what do you feel have been the main societal changes for women?
Wow.
Oh, that's a big question.
I know it is.
You can answer that one first.
Where do we start?
What changes?
I mean, it's obviously this.
I mean, there have been masses, I know.
No, of course.
What comes to mind first?
Well, I suppose that women are working. That's probably the biggest one, isn't it? Because up until then, they weren't really.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're working. It started off in publishing, I think. Lots of women would be in publishing. At the BBC, I did a spell at the BBC in the early 90s. And you know, all the, most of the editors, and they were women. Yeah, it is. That's probably the biggest shift, I think. There are so many more women in employment. I'm not saying that there's equal pay. But
that is interesting. Mm. What about you, Claire?
Well, I think women are so much more self-confident now than they were. If you look at footage, you know, interviews from the 80s, women seem to be very, you know, in the shadows, and they're much more...
they speak up more.
And, yeah, I mean, the latest things are the Me Too and all that kind of stuff going on, but it's in a slow process of women just being more happy to be themselves, really, I think.
I'm not sure. Because only yesterday on the news they were talking about how super drugs, places like that, are offering Botox surgery or something. Yeah. Have you heard about that one?
Mm.
And it's just like...
The boys are also suffering from the same...
Well, of course, it's an identity, sort of self-identity crisis, isn't it? That they're not happy in their bodies. So I don't know. I kind of dispute it, really, what you've just said. I don't know that the confidence is there.
Well, some women.
Well, some, but there always were some.
Yeah, yeah.
Weren't there? I mean, look at Margaret Thatcher. How much confidence she have? And Theresa May now, the old drone. How stubborn is she? You know, it's the arrogance and the stubbornness of her that... I don't know. So you always have some, won't you?
Do you feel any of these changes have been... that Greenham was the impetus for them?
No, because most of the people I talk to either didn't go to Greenham, haven't heard of Greenham.
No.
Yeah, so I wonder.
I'd like to think so, but I don't think it can claim that as an accolade. I don't think so.
Although it was a big movement, I don't know how much impact it had on... I mean, you didn't get to read that project, and I'm directing it at quality students that live 15 miles away, and most of them hadn't been there. I'm quite derogatory about it. I think it meant a lot to us. But,
Claire and I have both got qualifications in construction. I'm a joiner, carpenter, and Claire's a plumber. And I went on to lecture at Canterbury College. And there's such a dearth of women still to this day in construction. And they say in construction it's 0.5% are women. And they will be architects, presumably. But actually on the floor with the tools, there are very, very few. It's quite a rarity.
And is that the case still?
Mm. More. But I can't imagine that percent's gone up more than 1%. So, I mean, it's quite rare to see a woman with tools, isn't it? Might get the electricians and kind of clean jobs, but you know, women bricklayers and, you know, have you ever seen a woman bricklayer?
No.
You have?
Yeah.
Yeah, she'd be one of the 0.5%. Exactly. I mean, I did see a woman roofer once and that blew my mind. Although I'd been in construction for years, it was just so shocking. So that's an interesting statistic, isn't it? So although women are getting jobs and they are part of the workforce, I don't know what percentage of the workforce they are.
What was the question? Well, actually,
the influence of Greenham on the society of today, wasn't it?
But actually, what you are answering is something I was going to ask, is what changes have failed to take place that you feel should have.
Right.
And actually, what you're talking about now is really, really interesting, that there hasn't been a shift, a significant shift, into men's...
Domains,
yes.
But going back to the question you originally asked, what do you think? I mean, I know you're interviewing us, but what do you think? What's your view on it? Both of you. been hard to sort of...
It's a hard question, isn't it?
You know, 25 years and...
I agree with you about women are working much more.
Mm.
It is completely the norm, whereas...
Mm. It wasn't.
It wasn't. The other thing is that you are expected now, if you have children, to continue into or maintain your work rather than it used to be expected. But
you gave it up. Yeah.
The point at which you gave it up.
Unending maternity leave, yeah.
But is that also partly because they've cut benefits? They've changed, messed around with the ages that, I just not called income support anymore, is it? But the ages that you get child benefit or. Forced, I don't know. I wonder if it's also, we're talking more about working class families and middle class families.
I don't know. I think that women that have had children have to pay for childcare. And I've heard so many, Mercedes Waltman, most recently, say that there's no point because by the time they've, you know, gone out to work and they want to, and they've paid for their childcare, they're working for nothing. Do they have to look after their own children? So I think a lot of, I mean, yes, the female workforce has increased, but it might be that it's single women, the majority, rather than, unless they've got big, well-paying jobs, of course. If they're a director or something, they can afford their you know, their nannies and... what have you. But for the sort of average woman on the street, they're having that problem now, aren't they? Childcare.
What do you think has been the... What has been the legacy from Greenham for future generations?
That you can do it, you can make a change by... doing something yourself, not waiting for the decision makers to tell you what they're going to do, what they think should be the way forward. Yeah, you can have an impact.
And in numbers. That came out of
those sorts of movements
around then.
It's a bit like you know, I wonder why the NHS came into being. I don't believe it was because they wanted to make it a fairer world and look after our people. I think it's because our soldiers came back from the front so malnourished and in such a state that in order to keep the cannon fodder going for another war, they had to put in a system to keep them alive, to stop the whatever diseases they were coming back with. So I think often laws are implemented for not for just reasons. It's a bit like the suffragettes, you know. Did they get the vote because they campaigned, or did they get the vote because they were useful in the war? I don't know what am I saying. I'm going off on one. The impact of Greenham.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know whether it.
Well, it's gone back to common land, so that's one good thing, isn't it? We've got those Americans out of there. We went back, actually, together, didn't we? When was that, about 10 years ago? And it was really eerie.
Strange.
We drove around it, and then we were able to drive through main gate into the base. And it was just sort of industrial units, weren't there? But obviously the fences had all gone down round the perimeter, but there was still a gate, wasn't there, into the main bit where the silos were. And we did we walk along the runway?
Yeah.
I think we did, yeah.
So in the 90s we had the whole poll tax thing, didn't we? The poll tax riots. And we had huge opposition. And I think the confidence to do that probably came around through things like Greenham. I mean, I was involved in the Labour Party and Socialists and the militant tendency in the 80s. So I was kind of doing that sort of stuff. But most people weren't, whether they weren't. So I guess one demonstration can lead to the confidence for another, you know, another movement, if you like. So, Greenham has to have had an impact. It may not be that they achieved what they set out to achieve, but it would have rubbed off in, you know, other groups doing, having
the confidence to protest, to do other things. Yeah,
you know, Johnny was involved in the
Occupy
movement more recently.
Which is that, the Occupy movement?
Well, it was. Do you know more? Can you explain? It's kind of a sort of.
Really, it's just going to.
It's kind of.
What was it? They camped outside the Houses of Parliament, didn't they? And we had one outside the Turner, the art gallery.
Over, you know, banking and.
And was that women?
That was anyone.
No,
that was anyone.
But it was kind of people. Say young people, they weren't necessarily young people.
Why do you think it's important that Greenham is actually remembered by subsequent generations?
Because we were actually on the brink of extinction. And it was in American numbers. And I can never understand when Tony Blair said we have to rub shoulders with America. That was later, wasn't it? I don't know, it was what did they call us? The 55th state or something? Do you remember that? There's another demonstration I did, which was Little Rissington, and it was again American base, and they had a hospital with over 100 beds in the hospital under dust covers, purely in time for a nuclear war, and then only American servicemen would be able to use these facilities. And they had a thing of a 20-mile cordon-off area that they could commandeer any properties or anything in that area. That was how much, what's the word, power or... not power, but what am I trying to say? We sort of, somehow at that time, we were at the mercy, their mercy. And I think one of the things that Greenham did was highlight the fact that it was an American service, it was an American camp, that they had their own supermarket. It's not like they were giving anything back. They didn't shop locally. No, not at all. No, they were there with their guns on their hips behind three layers of fencing.
Land they'd stolen from.
I was just interested, you made me think. You mentioned Little Rissington and the hospital. Were you ever aware of people becoming ill in the Greenham area?
I read something, one of your articles, about how they thought that they were getting mild doses of radiation. Is that right? Mm. Mm. No, it was in one of your newspaper articles.
Okay. Was that supposition?
I didn't know at the time, but
based? Don't know.
As I say, I don't. Mm. I wasn't aware at the time. It's just something that I read about a fortnight ago when I read the things that. Mm. Quite a few women said that they were getting poorly since they'd been there. Mm. Mm. And so why wouldn't it leak, so to speak? Mm. Well, the other thing is that they thought that maybe the soldiers had sprayed them with something. Was that it?
I don't know.
I think from the inside out that they were patrolling round and possibly spraying something.
I mean, I think living like that probably means the time you're going to end up with bronchial.
I accept that, but I didn't know if there was ever any feeling that.
Mm, I think, yes, I did read about that.
I mean, there's talk
you obviously have heard word of it, whilst that question wouldn't be there.
Yes. I think when we're looking at the archives, there was a suggestion in one of the diaries we were looking at.
Okay, that they were vomiting and things like that. Mm.
Sort of the chemtrails thing now, isn't it? I mean, I don't know if there's any truth in it. Do you know?
I don't know.
But they're spraying us at night.
Could be. Yeah. Mm.
We're just looking at a calendar that Sally was part of creating.
Polly.
Sorry, I beg your pardon. I'm sorry. Polly, I beg your pardon. Just describe it, Polly.
We've got a big, powerful photo of lots of the women on one of the days, I think, at Main Gate, demonstrating, and a few quotes, one from the Green Common Women that say, "We aren't going away, we'll be here for as long as it takes," and Mahatma Gandhi saying, "There are no roads leading to peace, peace is the road."
It's very professional looking.
Yeah. Martin Luther King at the back, when you get to the end of the year, is revealed, "We must learn to live together as brothers or perish together as fools."
Poignant. And then there's another poster here.
Which is, it was found out, although it was undercover, that there was a hospital in a US air base in... I think it was in the Little Rissington Cotswolds, very near to Stowe, a little place called Little Rissington. And we marched from Stowe to Little Rissington just to highlight that this hospital was there. It had 1,500 beds under dust covers and lots of medical medicines and things like that, but it was purely for American servicemen at the time of a nuclear attack, which was very haunting when we got there. Obviously, it was a barred-up base, but we did manage to kind of get in there and walk around it.
Have you any idea which year this was in? We've got...
This one?
14th of April, but...
Yeah, what that had been... It was about 83, I think, possibly 84.
Right, the heading says, "Hospitals for today, not the day after." And then the byline is, "Peace march and rally to stop the building of a 1,500-bed USAF hospital for World War III." Interesting. Thank you.
There we
are. Ah, Duncan sorry, Campbell, speakers include Duncan... Campbell,
and Julie Christie was there, and I think Bruce Kent. I don't think it was Joan Ruddock wasn't there, but Bruce Kent was there that day.
Excellent, thank you. Yeah.